Session number 1076, Reel 2.
Dr. Pat Rawlins, Reel 2. Did you have special kit to go to travel with?
Oh, yes. Well, first of all, we were kitted out with khaki in British Red Cross uniform. It was officer's type of uniform. We didn't have Sam Browns and all that sort of thing, but it was a sort of rather superior battle dress kind of uniform with the ordinary cap with the Red Cross there, and we had Red Cross epaulettes as well. And let's see, what else? Well, we had army boots, of course, of which more anon. I remember the uniform, but I can't remember any other particular things. I think
How about your little medical bag? Did you take your own
equipment? Oh, no. I certainly took some of my own equipment. I'm afraid I just can't remember specifically now whether I had my own bag or not. I don't think I did, actually.
Could you tell me now about the party you left with?
Yes. We had the three teams. You see, there was the doctor, the three doctors. There was John Wilkes, Eric Waddington, and myself. And my team, I think we were actually divided into specific teams later on when we got to Jujing. But, I can't remember all of them, but I can remember Tom Kirkham, and he was a Norfolk man and a model, lovely painter, but I've never come across him since. There was Jeff Smith. I can't rattle the names off offhand now, but I could, with a bit of thinking, I could probably think of quite a lot of them.
Not to worry, it's a sort of size of the party.
Yes, well, with the three, I think it must have been about 30 of us all together, each team of about 8 to 10 people. Of course, there were no girls in those days. The first girls came out to China with great excitement among the boys while I was out there. And so we were all fellas, and we were all sort of parked in this dormitory in the Middlesex Hospital. And then after we'd done, I think, 3 or 4 months in the Middlesex, and then we had to go down to Bristol to learn to drive, which was a very enjoyable part of it, really, because we were put on to Dodge, I think it was, 10 tonners, and shown how to get these up and down the hills and twisty turns of Bristol, which were the nearest thing that they'd got to the Burma Road, and not far at all. In fact, I was amazed at how, I'd never been to Bristol before, I had no idea it was so hilly there, and, you know, all mountainous almost. And anyway, I quite soon picked that up, because I was always keen on driving, and I think we had a sort of basic test to pass, which I passed quite easily. And that's all I can say about that part of the training until round about November, sometime in November 43, we were all shipped off up to Liverpool to get aboard our convoy. And it was in November. It was dreadful weather. I'd never been into Liverpool before. Then I was given this awful surprise that by law, as there were more than 100 souls aboard this ship we were going to go on, and I was the senior of the three doctors, I was to be ship's MO. And I was shown around and discovered that there was one cupboard with a bit of Vaseline and some horrible medicines with number nines and rhubarb and things like that. And I got about 100 Lascar crew to doctor there. I'd never seen the sort of things that they had, skin things and so on. Anyway, we just had this one weekend when it was pouring with rain all the time, and in the blackout, of course, and I desperately went round Liverpool in the trams trying to find how to equip my surgical and medical cupboard, and in the end, I finished up at Evans. It was over the weekend, of course, you see, at Evans at Speke, who were marvellous and helped me with getting all hold of all sorts of things, and including some tetanus toxoid or anti-tetanus serum, which we hadn't got anything like that, you know. And so I sort of scraped together a rudimentary sort of medical kit there. And we sailed aboard the Harrison Line ship Advisor, which was an incredible-looking old hulk with a very tall chimney. But in fact, she was a pretty good ship because she could do 17 knots. She got an exhaust turbine on her propeller, which gave her an extra turn of speed. And then at the end of November, we sailed westwards in this big convoy. Of course, all the previous convoys, we'd heard terrible stories of bombings and torpedoings and all the rest of it. And we went seemingly sort of, we zigzagged, of course, but we're going due westward until this trip took, we didn't actually arrive. Difficult to describe it, really, because we didn't know where we were going or where we were, but we did, in fact, I believe, finish up somewhere near the American coast before turning south. And then we could have been, I should think, somewhere off Florida before we turned westward again. And we then didn't know whether we were going to go through the Straits of Gibraltar, which, of course, this was just about the time the Americans and Brits had got across into Sicily, and otherwise we would have had to go around the Cape, you see. But in fact, I believe the convoy before us had managed to get through Gibraltar with a lot of bombing, and we woke up one morning to see the rock quite close beside us, and we were going through. Then we sailed through the Med and all the way right across the Atlantic and back again and through the Med. We never saw a single German airplane or sub or anything. We were so lucky. Then, of course, we all hoped that we were going to get off at Suez, but they refueled there and wouldn't let us off. So the next thing was that we went down through the canal and out at Aden, and the rest of the convoy turned left and went off to Bombay. We were left on our own, crossing the Indian Ocean, making for Colombo. The reason for that was that we got three pilot cutters on our deck. They couldn't open the hatches until they got rid of these, and they were destined for Colombo. So we had a marvellous break, the first time ever since September 1939 that we'd seen lights at night. We sailed into Colombo and there was music and lights and food. And oh, it was marvellous. We had a superb week in Colombo. Well, we got these pilot cutters off, and we had to wait for another convoy. Take us all the way back to Bombay, and we explored the Ceylon, as it was then called. Went to Kandy and Lavender, what was it? Lavender Bay or something. And swam and everything. Oh, we had a lovely time there. And then we ultimately had to get back to our ship and went back with another convoy to Bombay. One of the marvellous sights. Something just occurred to me that I've missed out. While in the Indian Ocean, going across between Aden and Colombo somewhere, because we were zigzagging because of Japanese subs, it was Christmas Day of 1943, you see, and so we all wanted to go out and sing carols on deck, but the captain wouldn't let us. He said, you can't go out on deck because they'll detect any sound that isn't of the sea. The Japanese will detect that from miles away. So we were suppressed, and we had a bit of fun aboard instead, but we weren't allowed to go and sing carols on deck. And one of the other things, I don't know whether this is of interest at all, was seeing, of course, the flying fish used to come land on deck sometimes. We'd fry those for our breakfast. Huge manta rays used to come horizontally out of the water, and the mountain of water sort of just appearing to rise and then go flop down into the sea again. Absolutely incredible sights you saw there sailing the Indian Ocean. And of course on the way back to Bombay, the same thing. So ultimately it was, by the time we got back to Bombay, it was 1944, and I think about January 44. Then we were unshipped and we went to the, I think it was the French Service Unit Hostel, would it have been in Bombay, I think. And we had several days there, and then we took the train right across to Calcutta, where we went to the Friends Service Unit there, and I think it was best part of a fortnight in Calcutta before we finally were put aboard the old DC-3 aircraft. Was it, I think it was Dum Dum, was it, the airfield at Calcutta? And these were CNAC aircraft, China National Air Company or something, wasn't it called, with Chinese pilots and crew. But of course they were just cargo planes. They were just tin work inside, a long kind of, just like the old London trams with a bench down each side, but an aluminium bench, and you sat about 30 people down each side, and that was it. And you stayed like that until we got to Kunming. And going over the hump, you could see, I think they with full laden like that, they were just about capable of 19,000 feet, and the mountains were a good deal higher each side, you know, and you could see in the moonlight these great peaks each side of you. I'm not quite sure about this, but I think they only flew across at night, actually, because the Japanese fighters were still capable of getting across there. I don't quite know where from, but at any rate they were frightened of being shot down and hitting mountains, but there was an incredibly good safety record. I never actually heard of any aircraft either crashing or being shot down, and so we finally arrived safely at Kunming. And I remember seeing the Tomahawk fighters with their the Curtiss Tomahawk American with their shark. I can't just remember the name of the...
Would these be the Flying Tigers?
Flying Tigers, that's right, yes. They were all there in Kunming, squadron of them. And I forget if we actually spent a night in Kunming. I think we did. I think there was an FAU hostel in Kunming. We spent a night or two, I think, there, and then took the train to Jujing, which, as far as I recollect, was about half day's journey. That's, of course, spelt Kutsing, but pronounced Jujing. And so then we were then divided up into our teams and generally sort of given China convoy instruction. And I can't just remember, I think, who was in charge of that then. It was Pip Rivett later on, but I think Mike Crossfield was one of the people that came out with us, but there might have been a Cadbury in charge there then. I can't just remember now who it was, because I didn't know anybody then, you see. None of the FAU people were really any more than just names to me then, the people who were actually out there.
How did it impress you, though, when you first met the FAU organisation in China?
Oh, great. They were obviously, it was very, very kindly disposed, and everybody was extremely nice. I mean, that's all I can say, really. They were very efficient, very friendly, and soon, you know, they just made you feel at home, you know. And of course, we ate Chinese and everything. We had two very good Chinese cooks there who saw that we were internally supplied very nicely. And, you know, we're there. Well, we just sort of had to learn to be Chinese there. And I think we had a few language lessons as well while we were there, and had to more or less just be drilled in what we were going to do. And then we were divided into our teams, and of course Eric Waddington and John Wilkes and their teams were sent down to the southeast to Guiyang and Guizhou province, and my team, which consisted of, by then we'd sort of got ourselves divided up, there was myself as the doctor, Jane Wong, who was, of course, from Hong Kong. She was a Queen Alexandra Hospital trained SRN nurse. Myself, Jane, Dave Johnson, who'd come out with me, and he was trained as lab, laboratory and nursing. We had Charlie Liu as our interpreter. He'd done some training in medical work, and there must have been somebody else. Art Barr. Yeah, that was it. Art Barr was Dr. Barr. He was, the plan was for him to take us down there and then get us all set up. But I think there was a certain amount of uncertainty at this time, because, you see, we were originally supposed to be going down as a military unit. As the Japanese were expected to attack through Burma. But of course that never evolved, and during this time I wasn't really quite sure what was going on in the background, because I was new, but they were then presumably negotiating or agreeing things with the Wei Sheng Shu, which was the Yunnan health authority, to switch our team over to civilian work, you see. And it was known that there was terribly severe malaria. It was thought, I should say, that there was terribly severe malaria. It was known and thought that this malaria was decimating a lot of the villages down there. And by the time it was realised that we weren't going to be needed on the military side of things, they had fixed up for us to go under the Wei Sheng Shu down to Samoa, which was where the Americans were about to prepare a landing strip down there, you see. So we'd been switched over to civilian work, and I remember now. Oh, it's then. Of course, we were then sent back to Kunming, and we spent quite a time there getting our team ready with Art Bar. And of course, what it involved, unlike the other teams which had gone by truck to their various places, we had to walk down to our place, you see, and it was a 2-week walk over the mountain or more down to Samar. And so we were in Kunming for a bit of time getting horses and a team of horse muleteers or horsemen to take. We had 3 horses with. We were taking the horse loads of drugs and surgical equipment, most of which had been, of course, donated by the Canadian Red Cross. It seemed to be the Canadian Red Cross that were the great suppliers of our drug supplies. Some of it was British and some American, but mostly Canadian. So we had 3 horse loads, which included the drugs and, of course, our own personal stuff. I said we'd come to the army boots. And, of course, when we were getting ready to go, and, in fact, actually, we were just on the point of going when the Chinese people looked at our army boots and said, "You'll never do it in those, you see." And so Art Bar said, "Well, what are we supposed to go in?" "Oh, this is Tsohai, you see," which was the straw sandals. And at the last minute, we discarded our army boots, and each one of us, they made these personally for us, 2 pairs of Tsohai, which took us all the way down there. Absolutely marvellous. And it was the great thick straw soles. It didn't matter whether you got them wet or not. You paddled through streams and rivers with these. They soon dried out when you started going on. They were so comfortable too, and they were just marvellous. We just used these straw sandals. In fact, we never wore anything else after that. You could easily get a new pair made wherever you were, you know. So there you are. So we walked all the way down for our 2 weeks over the mountains. It was the most incredibly primitive sort of life going down there, because the fondien that we put up at were absolutely basic and primitive. There were, of course, the loos, as you know, were just potholes. The food was basic but good. You know, you could always get good rice and mostly a bit of pork or chicken or something done up with it, and vegetables. We very often chose to sleep in the stables, because one of the most awful things about everywhere, if you sat down on a chair, if you got in a bed, the bed bugs came at you, and they used to get underneath your thighs and down your legs and behind your knees, and produce these really horrible bites there. Another thing we had brought with us, a 5-gallon drum of dimethyl phthalate, which was the very new I believe it was a byproduct of the then very new plastics industry. And this we were to use as an anti-mosquito repellent, you see. And of course it was absolutely neat. It's still used nowadays in about 5% strength, but this was neat DMP, which we put on our skin like this. And by Jove, it worked, because you could put it on your face. You see, we didn't really have the proper facilities for putting mosquito nets up and things while we were, because we were taking our prophylactic mepocrine, as it was then, which made us all go yellow. We had to sleep in odd stables and places. We could never get mosquito nets to work properly. But we put this DMP on our skins, and it was really amazing because I think it burnt the mosquitoes' feet or something, because the moment that you could hear them going like this, you know, and then one would cut down on your face, you'd go, I got away. It really had been shot, you know. It was extraordinary. And the trouble was that, of course, we were very good about putting our DMP on our hands and things, any exposed parts after evening at night, in the evenings after dark. But, of course, if you were writing a letter home, we had these, of course, the old fountain pens. I had a beautiful Onoto fountain pen, I remember. And the thing started to dissolve in your hand when you were using this DMP, because it was a plastic solvent, and it had purely been found, I think, quite fortuitously that it was an insect repellent. But we had some funny experiences like that. We were very much guinea pigs with so many things like this. Anyway, we managed to steer clear of the mosquitoes with that, but it didn't seem to have much effect on the bed bugs, because they could bite right through your trousers and everything, you know, put these long proboscis through. So anyway, of course, we reached the Red River, which I think I'm right in saying flows parallel to the Mekong, east of it, is that right? We had our little convoy of horses, and there were other, of course, everything met up where there was this bridge across the Red River, which was about 3 or 4 foot wide, suspended on, I think, wire ropes or chains or something like this, with just boards across, through which you could see the river about 200 feet below. And the thing swayed from side to side, and it was, I should think it was 300 or 400 yards long of this from side to side. And so the amazing thing was the way these horses or ponies any Western horse would just refuse to do. These things just went sailing across there like that, and we sort of had to grip the sides and sort of try not to look down, you know. And it was really pretty vertiginous, you know. You felt when you got to the other side, you had to sort of climb up the other side. The centre part sagged right down, and you had this great climb up the other side. And anyway, we somehow got across, but I think there had been some casualties at other times, but we all got over there. That was, I suppose, about halfway down to Mohe. And then, of course, as I said, we were supposed to go to Samao. I've never really found out the truth of this. The only person who could tell you would be Jane Wong, who could understand what was going on, but I couldn't, you see. We reached this little place, Mohe, which was a salt mining place. I don't know whether at some time perhaps I could describe how the salt was got to where it was, but that's not really part of this story. Anyway, we reached this place where, after a bit of delay, Art Bar told us we were going to stay. Now, I think, reading between the lines, there was certainly this feudal kind of warlord chap we knew as Colonel Jang. What I think happened was that he told us we were going to stay.